Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
It's The Takeaway for April 23rd, and we've got a lot of stuff to get to. The Trump administration wants to ask about citizenship on the 2020 census, and the Supreme Court hears the challenge today.
If they ask this question, the question of citizenship to the U.S. Census, it will result in a dramatic undercount of our nation's Hispanic population.
We lay out the case and hear how a question about citizenship on the census could affect one community with a large Latino population. And Ukraine's president-elect's previous career was as a TV comedian. Yep.
It's not a TV series. This is lives on the line.
And we dissect Senator Elizabeth Warren's student debt forgiveness plan. Do you have student debt?
I'm terrified about my debt.
My debt has prevented me from saving for a down payment for a house.
To make myself feel better, I've always just looked at it as a car payment for a car that I never was able to drive.
Your takes and more coming up. Let's get to it. The citizenship question on the 2020 census is going before the Supreme Court today. It's the culmination of a year-long battle over whether the Trump administration's decision to include the question,
"Is this person a citizen of the United States?"
is constitutional. Census experts and immigration advocates are concerned that the question will decrease response rates, particularly among immigrant communities. The Census Bureau estimates that adding the question would cause 6.5 million fewer people to fill out the census. And that can have a big impact on what resources states get. Around 300 financial assistance programs allocate over $800 billion per year based on data from the census. But the administration argues that the citizenship question is important for the Justice Department. And we're going to talk about it today. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Coming up, we'll focus on how one community is handling the incoming census amid fears that the Latino community is being undercounted. But first, we turn to Amber McKinney, managing editor for Law 360, for the basics of the case. Amber, thanks for being with us.
It's great to be with you.
So much happening today, so much going on. What does the Constitution say about a citizenship question on the census? Let's start there.
Sure. The Constitution says that all of the population needs to be enumerated, and that's the word they use. So it doesn't really define whether or not you should count undocumented immigrants, the same as everyone else in the country. It just says a total enumeration of people.
And so it says the population, right? So it's everybody.
Yep.
It doesn't say
that's
from
right.
Where. Okay, so now that we're clear on what the Constitution says, let's talk about what the lower court arguments have been for why the citizenship question should not be on the census.
Yeah, we've had three lower courts look at this in the year since Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross tried to put this on the census, and they've all pretty stridently said that it can't be done for a few reasons. There have been some administrative procedures that he didn't do properly, but the real crux of it boils down to why they wanted to put this question on the census in the first place. And there's been a lot of discussion about that, a lot of discovery about emails back and forth about reasons why. Wilbur Ross says it's because the Department of Justice wanted to better enforce some federal voting rights laws. But the states and other people challenging this said that was just bunk. They said it wasn't true at all, and courts have agreed so far.
So that's what we mean when we say they want to get this data to the Justice Department to
that's
make
right.
sure people who are registered to vote, the numbers match up, right, with who's voting versus who's in the population.
Yeah, there's been a lot of focus on making sure that voting is done properly in this country. We saw some commissions out of the White House on that a couple years ago, if you recall. So that's the genesis of where some of this rationale started. But the people who have challenged it and the courts that have reviewed it said that that was an after-the-fact thing that they said, that they've been wanting to add the citizenship question for other reasons well ahead of that. And I think part of helping to understand this is it's easy to forget why we do the census in the first place. And the reason we do the census is to do two big things. One is to allocate billions of dollars with a B. So it's big money we're talking about. And the second reason is to figure out how many representatives each state has in Congress. So this could have really huge impacts if we undercount communities. And most of the undercount would be expected to happen in Democratic areas.
And Are we getting a sense of how the justices might lean in this case? We have new justices on the bench right now. The Supreme Court is hearing oral arguments today. Where do the bench is tending towards the right conservative right now? How do we think the justices might rule?
You know, I try not to speculate about the justices because it's a bit of a fool's errand most of the time. But I can say that they're going to make a definitive ruling here because this got fast tracked to them in the first place. This skipped an appellate level of review, which means it's a very unusual case. And the reason it's gone so fast is because this has to be decided by the end of June. The Census Bureau has to start printing forms. And July 1st is the date they need to hit print on all of those.
Sounds pretty basic, but it's a pretty intense situation here. Would the Supreme Court decision be the end of it, regardless of how the Supreme Court rules? Or if they rule a certain way, do states have the potential to come back and say, actually, no, this is how we want to run our state?
So typically, the Supreme Court tries to have narrow rulings where they only decide on the very core things and not go beyond their bounds in some ways. But I don't expect that here because they really do have to hit print on those forms. So we're expecting the Supreme Court to actually give an answer. I don't think they would have taken this up and fast-tracked it the way they did if they weren't going to provide some resolution here.
Amber McKinney is the managing editor of Law 360. Amber, thank you so much.
Thanks a lot for having me.
And we go now to Milwaukee, where the citizenship question on the census is worrying the local Latino community. In 2010, the local chapter of the League of United Latin American Citizens, also known as LULAC, began a community outreach campaign to inform the Latino community about the census process. More than 100,000 Latinos were counted in Milwaukee in that census, thanks in part to those outreach efforts. Still, local outreach organizers and activists think the count was lower than it could have been. Now, with the addition of the citizenship question on the census, they're getting worried.
There are concerns with not just the undercount, but that this administration will actually go ahead and find a way to release the information. Should the question be there and people actually answer it honestly, they're afraid that information will be given to ICE.
That's Daryl Morin, a Latino community leader in Milwaukee and the former National Vice President Midwest for LULAC. He helped organize the 2010 census outreach efforts to the Latino community.
During the 2010 census, I actually worked directly with Dr. Groves at the U.S. Census Bureau, and we put together a program by which we really focused on making sure we had materials that we could distribute in the communities that were both in English and Spanish. We developed PSAs that we provided to our partners in radio and television, as well as with the Spanish press. And we also made sure that we had people who were known in the community, people who were bilingual, going door to door, knocking and asking the questions for the Census Bureau. That actually resulted in additional funding going to the city of Milwaukee and the state of Wisconsin and more elected Latino representation.
We mentioned in the introduction to this story that there were a total of 103,007 Latinos in Milwaukee in 2010. Is there a sense that that number could have been higher? And if so, how do we know that?
Between the Census Bureau has what's called the American Community Survey, where it's a little bit more in depth, et cetera. But we know between that, we know between payments being made to Social Security and other government agencies, et cetera, we have a pretty good handle on the number of folks that are there when we get the expected returns back from the census. So in 2010, we did find, in fact, there was a 74% increase over the previous decade of Latinos. And without that, Milwaukee would have seen a serious loss of funding for our schools, for our roads, and for healthcare for its residents.
Let's talk a little bit more about that funding, because we know, according to the Census Bureau in 2014, Latinos in the United States had a poverty rate of nearly 24%. What does it look like in Milwaukee, and how could a miscount or an undercount impact those resources?
Well, we actually launched a new program here called the Hispanic Collaborative, and we're looking exactly at that issue. One of the dynamics we found with some of the data we used from the U.S. Census was that even though Latinos had the highest workforce participation rate in the Metro Milwaukee area, we had the highest poverty rate. And it's having access to that data that really allows us to tailor programs to address the real issue there.
I'm wondering what the 2020 census is going to look like, whether this question makes it in or not. What are the outreach efforts so far? Are there folks planning to figure out a way to deal with the question if it makes it into the census?
So sadly, yes, we are having to make a contingency plan. Our hope is that the Supreme Court, they're hearing arguments today, will come down on the side of the actual Constitution. Right in the Constitution, it never refers to, you know, those people that are lawfully present or citizens. It refers to persons and numbers. So we hope that they do follow the Constitution in this. But this being said, we already know that the U.S. Census Bureau has developed two forms of the census. And depending on the verdict, it will go out. Either way, you'll find LULAC, you'll find the Hispanic Federation, and Unidos, and a host of other organizations across the country doing everything we can to get our people out and to make them represented. Because there's two things. Most people typically talk about the census with regards to funding. But what's even more important, and the part that's actually in the Constitution, is it determines the representation in the U.S. House of Representatives. So if we have states with high Latino populations and there's an undercount there, that means they will not get the number of representatives in Congress that they deserve. And that is very important to our community.
There are also concerns about the census, or there were, you know, before the census question about citizenship came up, there were many questions about how Latinos were even being identified in the census racially. I'm not sure if you have any thoughts on that or if you know where that stands today.
Well, there was considerable effort that goes into the census to ask people their race or their ethnicity, et cetera, because there are many Latinos of many colors, right? You have Filipino Latinos, you have some from Central and South America, you have European Latinos, et cetera. So that is a question that is asked and quite honestly, still continues to be an issue for those people breaking down the numbers at the Census Bureau. But it's something that we'll continue to work on. And once again, nothing helps resolve the issue than making sure people are educated, know what box to check when they fill out the census.
Do you expect, regardless of the contingency plans that you're talking about being put in place or not, do you expect that this concern about a citizenship question will result in fewer Latinos filling out the census across the board?
Yes. We know that most people think of this as only having an impact on the undocumented. But we know, once again, it's been statistically proven that this will result in an undercount of all Latinos, as sometimes they live in mixed households, et cetera.
And when you say mixed households, you mean undocumented with people who are citizens, right?
Correct. Correct. And so our fear is that it will have an exponential factor in the undercount. And here we just recently saw a new survey came out that talked about the disparity of education in our nation between those who have and who have not. And imagine if we further cut those resources to our schools, to our hospitals, et cetera, the dramatic impact that'll have and elimination of the ability to move into the middle class for so many in our community.
Daryl Morin is the former National Vice President of the Midwest for LULAC. Daryl, thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
The new president of Ukraine is a man who plays the president of Ukraine on TV. That's actually his TV show's theme song. Volodymyr Zelensky is a comedic actor with no government or military experience who will now preside over a country in conflict with Russia. Here to talk with me about this ironic election and the role of Russian influence over it is Nina Jankowicz, global fellow at the Wilson Center's Cannon Institute. Welcome to The Takeaway, Nina.
Thank you for having me, Tanzina.
Zelensky's lack of experience doesn't seem to have been a concern for voters. What message is this sending us from Ukraine voters?
They are looking for someone who doesn't represent the status quo, who doesn't represent the way things have been done in Ukraine for a few decades now since Ukraine's independence. And even though Zelensky is a bit of a novice, they like that blank slate. In fact, one voter in Ivano-Frankivsk told me, "I'm glad he's not making any promises because I don't want him to break them." So that kind of gives you a little bit of an idea of the headspace that Ukrainian voters are coming into this with. And they're just tired of this stagnation that has characterized their lives for, you know, a couple of decades at this point.
How does Zelensky compare to the incumbent, Poroshenko?
Well, I think Petro Poroshenko is a traditional Ukrainian politician in that he was a minister before this. He came into power after the Revolution of Dignity, or as Americans might know it, the Euromaidan Revolution 5 years ago. And before all of this, before he got into politics, he owned and still owns a chocolate company. And he owns this chocolate company and is one of Ukraine's most wealthy individuals. And that is very characteristic of the way that Ukraine has done politics for a long time. Now, that's not to say that Petro Poroshenko hasn't achieved very, you know, significant reforms for Ukraine. It's just that the reforms that he has achieved have not trickled down to the normal people. Folks I was talking to out in Kryvyi Rih, especially, which is this industrial city that mines iron ore, those folks are living in a lot different conditions than what I see here in Kyiv, and especially the pensioners who are living on maybe $100 a month. They really want to see real reform. They don't want to be living hand to mouth anymore. They want to be able to retire comfortably, and that's not something that Poroshenko has really delivered on, those hopes of dignity in life in Ukraine. That's why they call it the Revolution of Dignity. And that was a lot of motivation for voters as they went to the ballot box yesterday here.
And we also, yeah, obviously Zelensky, as we've mentioned, does not have experience doing this. He's a political outsider. But is he really operating totally out of the political sphere here?
So there are a couple big questions hanging over his presidency as we wait for him to be inaugurated in early June. The first one, I would say, is his relationship with oligarch Igor Kolomoisky, who runs the TV station and owns the TV station that not only his sitcom, Servant of the People, which actually his political party is also named after, but a number of other of his television shows, which are all comedy shows, have aired on over the past couple of years. So Zelensky is this successful businessman who has a business relationship with one of the richest men in Ukraine. It's also important to note that Kolomoisky defrauded the Ukrainian people of $5.5 billion. He owned Privatbank, which was one of the largest banks in Ukraine, and that bank had to be nationalized when it was discovered that he stole that money from the Ukrainian people. So the relationship between Kolomoisky and Zelensky is really something that's hanging over Zelensky's head right now. He has said he's going to distance himself from Kolomoisky, and on his team, he has appointed the former finance minister who was in charge of that nationalization of the bank, but also on his team is one of Kolomoisky's lawyers. However, he has said this is the end of the era of greed. That was one of his slogans for the campaign. So I think voters will be very, very disappointed very quickly if it becomes clear that that relationship is closer than they would like.
Zelensky is an outsider. Does being an outsider mean that he'll be more vulnerable to outside influences, as were suggested in the Mueller report with President Trump and the Russians?
I would really hesitate to make a comparison between Zelensky and Trump. Zelensky, I think, is a true Ukrainian patriot. He has recognized time and time again that Russia is Ukraine's enemy. And again, I think the voters are going to hold him to account if he gives an inch to Russia. So that's number one there. And I know diplomats here are going to be seeking to influence him to make sure that he has the support that he needs from the West in order to continue to stand up to Russia. That being said, Russia has, as you know, posited that he might be more amenable to negotiation. And Zelensky himself has said, you know, he's up for a creative solution to the Donbass conflict, which has now taken 13,000 Ukrainian lives, not only combatants, but also elderly and children. There are a lot of children who step on landmines and things out there who can't get out of the conflict zone. So I think, you know, people are eager to see this conflict come to a close, and they recognize that Petro Poroshenko's way of going about things wasn't really bringing any movement to the conflict. So they're looking for that creativity. I hope personally that Zelensky is able to surround himself with the advisors that he needs. It's not a TV series. This is lives on the line, and he needs someone who's really experienced advising him. And to his credit, he did say that he would be rolling out a Donbass peace plan in the next couple of weeks, and that he would be soliciting feedback, which has kind of been a hallmark of his campaign.
So, Nina, there was a lot of Russian influence in the last election in Ukraine. Did we see similar influence in this election?
Well, I think that a lot of the Russian influence, especially online, has moved underground in this Ukrainian election, and that's for two reasons. One, to its credit, Facebook has introduced some measures which make it a little bit more difficult for malign actors to abuse the platform in the ways they used to. And the second thing is that I think Ukrainians have become much more savvy about who is influencing them, not only online, but in their media sphere as well. And for that reason, I think pushing those Russian narratives has become a little bit harder for the Kremlin to do. And then, of course, there is a third factor, which is that actually the disinformation that I saw by and large in this election was coming from the campaigns themselves. However, I will say that a lot of it was coming from one side, and that was the losing side, the Poroshenko campaign, which I think took the gloves off as they realized that they were in kind of a bad spot here in Ukraine. And I think the fact that they were defeated so soundly is a rejection of those tactics.
I wonder if there are any lessons there for the United States as we lead up to our own elections in 2020.
There absolutely are. There absolutely are. I think it's important for us to recognize, particularly as our leaders in Congress are considering social media regulation, that disinformation is a threat, whether it comes from Russia, whether it comes from Iran, or whether it comes from, you know, inside of our own borders. And it certainly is coming from inside our own borders. And it's something we need to recognize and call out. It's a threat to democracy, no matter which way you look at it. And we need our democratic discourse to be based in fact.
Nina Jankowicz is a global fellow at the Wilson Center's Kennan Institute and has been covering the election in Ukraine with support from the Pulitzer Center on Crisis Reporting. Nina, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
All right, let's hear a little more from that theme of Servant of the People, the show of the now Ukrainian president-elect Volodymyr Zelensky. Pretty catchy, actually. On Monday, 2020 presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren rolled out a policy proposal that would affect more than 40 million people in the United States.
Anyone who's got outstanding student loan debt can have up to $50,000 worth of student loan debt canceled out so long as their income is under $100,000, then it kind of steps in up to there's no help for anybody whose family income is above $250,000. And that's it.
That's Warren on CNN laying out the central piece of her proposal. Her plan also includes free tuition for public colleges and creates a $50 billion fund for historically black colleges and universities and minority-serving institutions. Warren's college finance plan goes further and into more detail than any other presidential candidates. But she's not the only one talking about this. With people in the United States owing a collective $1.5 trillion in student debt, this crisis is a pressing concern for many voters heading into the next election.
And it is now crushing them. So my proposal is to say this isn't right.
Annie Nova is here to talk about all this. She's a personal finance reporter for CNBC covering education. Annie, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
So how does Warren's debt forgiveness plan, how is it different from others that we may have seen in the past?
So the idea that Americans are struggling more and more with student debt is something that is getting more attention. More voters want to hear about it. It's something that's affecting them every day. And you've seen for a while now some talk about student debt, but this is the boldest, most detailed proposal. So you have another candidate, Wayne Messam, who has talked.
Who?
Wayne Messam.
Okay.
He is a mayor in Florida. He's much less well-known, but he is in the running. And he has called for eliminating student debt. But he doesn't really have any details around that. You have Elizabeth Warren, who has now come out with a proposal to very specifically erase $50,000 in student debt for anyone who makes under $100,000. If you earn between $100,000 and $250,000, you will get a lesser but still a sizable portion of your debt eliminated. Whereas you have other candidates like Bernie Sanders talking about free college. A lot of other candidates have also talked about free public college. This is the first detailed proposal to actually get rid of student debt.
What's been the response so far? Because we're hearing, you know, there are candidates every day coming out with big talking points. But like you said, this is a very detailed, very specific policy proposal. Across the board, how are people responding? Because student loan debt is something that affects a lot of Americans.
Yeah, I think it was, you know, one of our most trending stories at CNBC yesterday, which is interesting because we're known as being a business network investors. But actually, people are very, very excited by this. 70% of people who leave college now are in debt. And this proposal definitely, I think, resonates with them.
Are there any shortcomings in the plan? I mean, these are big pie in the sky ideas. These sound really good. But do you see any pushback, any shortcomings so far?
I think you will definitely see criticism. Anytime you see a massive forgiveness plan, there's going to be pushback. Republicans are not going to like it. They don't like grand forgiveness plans around student debt or other types of financing. And then you have some people saying that, does it target the people who need the help the most? It will, again, if you earn below $250,000, you stand to have a sizable portion of your debt forgiven. Some might say, well, why don't we target the people who actually graduated and couldn't get a job or are working minimum wage? Why are we offering this to so many people?
Annie, one of the issues that's come up here is also race, as we know. You wrote about a study last year that examined some of the racial disparities that exist in student loan debt. What were some of the findings in that study?
Yeah, the findings are interesting. So black students borrow much more than white students for a number of reasons. They have less family wealth. The average family value of a black family is around $4,000 compared to over $150,000 for white families. So, of course, they have less savings. They're going to need to borrow more. And they tend to also be black students tend to be targeted by for-profit schools that can have lower quality education and much higher tuition. They borrow more, then they go on and they can earn less and they have less support again from family and they take longer to repay their debt. So not only do they take on more, they're in debt longer and they have higher default rates.
So what would Elizabeth Warren's plan do for black borrowers in particular? Would it have any measurable effect on borrowers of color, students of color, as compared to white students, or would it affect everybody equally?
Yeah, there were some student loan experts who quickly analyzed her proposal, and they found that it would do a lot to narrow that kind of astounding wealth gap because all of a sudden your value goes up when your debt balance goes down.
Let's talk a little bit about how pervasive student loan debt is. We talked a little bit about it in the beginning, but when we think about financial decisions, I always say the biggest financial decision I ever made before buying a home was deciding where I was going to go to school. I mean, it was really based on how much I could afford. How do most people make decisions? Are they doing it based on what they can afford, or are they doing it based on the perceived value of the degree and saying, you know what, I'll just take out all the loans I need to because this is a great school?
I think you have Americans making one of, if not the most important financial decision of their lives at 18, right out of high school. I certainly wasn't prepared to make that decision then, and I think a lot of people are not. There is this idea that you have to take on whatever debt you have to take on in order to finance your education, because you can't not go to college, and sometimes you can't, you know, not go to the college you want to go to. And you see that's why there are more and more parents taking on debt to also make their child's education possible. And there's not a lot of consideration of what you're going to study, what kind of job you might get afterward, and that's what leads so many people to not be able to repay this debt afterward.
What's the impact that inability that many Americans have to pay back these loans, what impact is that having on us as a society?
I think it's having a huge impact. When people leave college, there's just been studies showing that the different aspects of your lives that are affected. People who owe more debt tend to have a lower chance of being in a job in the field that they studied because they have to go on and they have to take a job right away to pay off that all of a sudden monthly student loan bill, as opposed to taking a little bit of time and finding the right job. And that has effects throughout people's entire career. Homeownership rates among young people are down. Entrepreneurship rates are down. People are really stifled throughout their 20s and 30s. And it also, they have lower retirement savings. And the effects kind of ripple throughout your life. And I spoke to a woman who was 80 and she was still paying off her loans.
80?
Yeah,
80. 80.
80. Student debt is growing very fast among older people because they're taking on student debt for their children and they have not been able to repay the debt they originally took out for their education.
Annie Nova is a personal finance reporter for CNBC covering education. Annie, this has been fascinating. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
80?
Yeah.
And we're wondering, how have your loans impacted your life after college?
My name is Eden. I'm in Oxford, Mississippi. I really wish I had more counseling on what it actually meant to take on so much debt, especially as basically a child myself, as I was getting ready to go into college. I wish I had taken a different school path, maybe by taking community college courses before finishing my degree at a university. Instead, now I'm 5 years out from my degree. I'm still $48,000 in student loan debt after I received 75% tuition scholarships every year that I was in college already. It's just a sort of a looming burden.
Andrew from Boca Raton, Florida. Education used to be seen as an investment in future generations, and now it's just seen as a cost and a tax. So what's the result of that lack of investment in education? Well, we have the first generation that's actually going to do worse than their parents.
This is Amanda from North Bangor. I'm terrified about my debt. I have a dual degree and thought for sure I'd get a good job right off. It turns out you need more than an associate's degree. So I started my online college journey. I will have my BA in human services in a couple of weeks, but I'm not so sure. I'm questioning now if it was worth it. I'm going to be paying on these loans for the rest of my life.
Josh Brown, Searcy, Arkansas. And if our family didn't have student loan debt, we'd be able to live a much more comfortable life. We'd be able to give more generously to the charities that we love.
This is Thomas Cavanaugh from San Rafael, California. I graduated with about $15,000 in undergraduate debt, then stacked up about another $45,000 getting a PhD. My student loan payments are nearly $1,000 a month. I chose a lucrative field and I have a six-figure salary, but my debt has prevented me from saving for a down payment for a house and starting a family. I'll be 42 by the time I pay it off, and sometimes financially it really feels like I'm just trying to push water uphill.
Thanks for sharing your student loan stories. Please share your story with us on Twitter at The Takeaway. And that's our show for today. If you have any thoughts for us, you can give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. I'm Tanzina Vega. This is The Takeaway, and thanks so much for listening.